computers, with all of the contraptions that we have created. Question will be, you know, in 50 to 300 years, from his point of view, Vinci's point of view, to what degree is there going to be some human element left in this, and insofar as we mean human, or a conscious element in this, a human consciousness element? And I think it's very important that we attempt to make sure that that's there, because we need a level of wise, ethical guidance and comprehension of what we are doing and merging with our technology, which is what's got lots of people worried right now, that we are not wisely and ethically guiding the evolution of our machines and our merging with machines. So we need that. We need
Yeah. I think that's incredibly important.
Yeah.
A number of AI researchers have resigned from doing this work, and others are actively working on it while saying the work I'm doing may mean the end of the human race.
Yeah.
Now, that could be overly dramatic, but at the same time, you know, it leads one to wonder, you know, where are the ethical constraints here? If these people truly feel like the work they're doing could wipe out humanity, why do they continue doing it? Why show up to work in the morning?
Well, they could think something like this, Tim. Here's an example. I wish I could throw out, illustrate a lot of this with more science fiction examples than I have, but they're in the corner of my mind. They keep informing me as I go along. We could think that, you know, we don't have to be so vain to think that we're at the final level of perfection achievement in the evolution of the universe. So what if something comes after us, something different? Maybe that's for the better, okay?
I think as we get further on, we can actually do that more and more responsibly, and more that really would match that person, and actually emulate the way he would move and so on, his tone of voice.
Well, you know, my dad, he loved Brahms too, particularly those piano trios. So if we can solve the back taxes problem, we'll get my dad and your dad's bots.
Physics, we call it a singularity.
As are all of Ray's books, but you agree?
The answer to that question is kind of the same as it is now, but first of all, the reason it's called a singularity is because we don't really fully understand that question. Singularity is borrowed from physics. Singularity in physics is where you have a black hole and no light can escape, and so you can't actually tell what's going on inside the black hole. And so we call it a singularity, a physical singularity. So this is a historical singularity, but we're borrowing that term from physics and call it a singularity, because we can't really answer the question. If we actually multiply our intelligence a millionfold, what's that like? It's a little bit like asking a mouse, gee, what would it be like if you had the amount of intelligence of this person? The mouse wouldn't really even understand the question. It does have intelligence. There's a fair amount of intelligence, but it couldn't understand that question. It couldn't articulate an answer. That's a little bit what it would be like for us to take the next step in intelligence by adding all the intelligence that the singularity would provide.
Wait, I just want to make sure I understand.
But I'll give you one answer. I said if you're diligent, you'll achieve longevity, escape velocity in 5 or 6 years. And if we want to actually emulate everything that's going on inside a brain, let's go out a few more years, say the 2040, 2045. Now there's a lot, you talk to a person, they've got all the connections that they had originally, plus all this additional connections that we add through having them access computers, and that becomes part of their thinking. Suppose that person blows up, if something happens to their mind, you definitely can recreate everything that's of a computer origin, because we do that now. Anytime we create anything with the computer, it's backed up. So if the computer goes away, you've got the backup and you can recreate it. It says, okay, but what about the thinking in their normal brain that's not done with computers? We don't have some ways of backing that up. When we get to the singularity by 2045, we'll be able to back that up as well. Because we'll be able to figure out, we'll have some ways of actually figuring out what's going on in that sort of non-biological, non-mechanical brain. And so we'll be able to back up both the normal brain as well as the computer edition. And I believe that's feasible by 2045.
In your vision of it...
So you can back up the entire brain. Now, that doesn't guarantee, I mean, the whole world could blow up and lose all the data centers. So it's not an absolute guarantee.
That would be a shame. But what I don't understand is, will we even be fully distinct people if we're sharing memories and we're all uploading our brains to the cloud and we're getting all this information coming back directly into our neocortex? Are we still distinct?
Yes, but we could also find new ways of communicating. So computers would extend my brain, and computers would extend you.
It'll be almost impossible to tell. It will feel like you're in a simulation because everything will look manufactured. Everything will look produced. And it's very important that you shift your mindset, or you attempt to shift your mindset, to verifying the things that you feel you need through your experience, through your intuition. Because all these devices in your bags, in your pockets, they're offloading from that image of the neuron, essentially. And because all these things are on your phone now, you're not building those connections in your brain anymore.
Dorsey would like all of us to only verify by experiencing. Like, that is not a scalable model for a tech CEO to be recommending. It's quite weird. How can I know what is being reported, for instance, in China? I'm not there. I'm here in London. The whole point of news is that we need a system of contributors who put forward evidence that other people peer review, and then it's discussed as truth. I mean, this is taking us back to philosophy. What is reality? Or the study of history. How do we treat sources? Or even the law. What is evidence? What is not? What is admissible in court? What is not? Telling everybody that we just have to, you know, go with our intuition doesn't feel great.
Can you protect the democracy, Connor, if you can't differentiate what is real and what is fake?
I mean, yeah, definitely not easily, that's for sure. A lot of what makes a society possible is that we can agree on something being true or not. If we can't fundamentally agree on what is true or not, then, and especially if the things that we believe are true or not are maybe selected by people or things that do not have our best interests at heart, whether it's to sell us something or to make us angry or to make us do some political thing, then you can't form a state, you can't form a civilization in the limit.
It's kind of interesting, Daryl, that he's putting the onus on us, because I would say if you can't differentiate, then that is an existential risk for them, for the social media companies. Why would you ever tune in if it's just bringing fake news?
Absolutely. I mean, to try and put the burden on the consumer or the user is moving the proportion of blame to the wrong place. It's the tech companies that are providing the technology. They should have the intelligence behind that technology to be able to identify if something is true or if it's false or not. Ultimately, the user at the end is the last line of defense. If we're having to use our intuition, then the system has failed to get to that point.
In the early 80s, these are very predictable phenomena. That graph on the right is the number of bits we move around wirelessly in the world. So that was Morse code over AM radio, essentially, today's 4G networks. Again, trillions fold increase, that's a logarithmic scale. Look at how predictable the trajectory that is. Internet data traffic doubling every year. That's the graph on the left that I had of the internet. I had the first few points. That's called the ARPANET, as I mentioned. The graph on the right is the same data, but seen on a linear scale. That's actually how we experience the world. We don't experience it in this logarithmic domain. So right around the late 90s, it looked like the web just came out of nowhere. Brand new thing, World Wide Web. But you could see it coming if you looked at the exponential trajectories. I mentioned biology, I mentioned a few examples. DNA sequencing costs very smoothly coming down by half every year. The amount of genetic data doubling every year. But also our ability to model and simulate these processes, to actually understand how does a genetic cause of cancer or heart disease work? What are the genetic indicators? How can we reprogram these processes away from disease? Is also progressing exponentially. I'll give you another example that combines several different exponentially improving information technologies. This girl had a damaged windpipe. She was not going to be able to survive with it, so they imaged her throat with non-invasive imaging. The spatial resolution of non-invasive imaging is doubling every year. That's helping us understand the brain. I'll come to that in a moment. They then designed her a new windpipe inside the computer using computer-assisted design, another exponentially progressing capability. They then printed out a new windpipe for her using biodegradable materials using a three-dimensional printer, then populated it with her modified stem cells using the same 3D printer, and grew out a new windpipe for her and installed it surgically, and it worked just fine. We are routinely actually replacing simple organs, windpipes, tracheas, esophagus, other simple organs in humans. We're doing it with complex organs in animals. I'm involved with a company where we're actually growing just in the lab using three-dimensional printing and modified stem cells, lungs, and installing them successfully in pigs, which are actually very close biologically to humans.
What we would hope for is that this better that comes after us, this intelligence that comes after us, presumably with consciousness, is going to have a certain character traits to it, ethical, wisdom-based traits to manage and negotiate reality better than we do. Because in a lot of ways, we may be doing well, but in a lot of ways we're not doing very well. Okay?
Yeah.
And so I wouldn't get particularly upset if we disappeared and something better came along. Like, they made a movie, which you probably have seen, based on Isaac Asimov's I, Robot series.
God, these artifacts, these super creatures, live forever, you know, be immortal, they're thinking.
My grandmother and grandfather wrote a book called Cradles of Eminence, where they studied the childhoods of famous people. And one thing they found was that, so the great scientists, they'd almost always had very lonely childhoods. They had no friends, they were isolated. Then they had some important person, either a parent or an uncle or a teacher, interested them in science when they were very young. Many of them were sick in their adolescence.
I grew up in my early childhood in Eugene, Oregon, in the early 1970s, so I was surrounded by peace-loving hippie guys with long hair tossing around weird ideas. I started college when I was 15, so I was quite young, but I studied mathematics. And until I was about 27, 28, I was doing research scattered in all sorts of different things. When I started my career as a scientist, I was interested in a bunch of big problems, like how to make spacecraft to travel to other stars, how to make time machines to go back in time, and theoretical physics and simulating events. I feel strongly that human consciousness comes about as a consequence of certain complex structures in the human brain.
Just hanging the past. Right?
Yeah, yes. Cool. I stumbled across her while I was writing the book. So her claim to fame was sort of using that wisdom of crowds in employing democracy in Taiwan, having people be able to pitch in and listen to the discussion, the politicians, say what they liked and didn't like. And I thought that was just a mind-awakening idea. And this, I think, is, if I understand it, the same idea applied to how a business works, and I think that's a very interesting idea. I don't know that it answers everything. I don't think everybody can become an influencer. Some people have very successfully, but whether that's enough that you can make a gainful employment by everybody who is unemployed by AI, not clear to me. I think retraining can help if you find yourself losing a job, but I think that's insufficient to employ everybody who might need it. It is a very complex and disruptive idea.
That's one respected philosophy of consciousness. It isn't mine. So when I'm around AI people discussing consciousness, I'm almost always the outlier. In the view that I take, consciousness, awareness, is the ground. It's the base of which everything is formed. And then different structures manifest consciousness in different ways. So a human brain manifests universal consciousness in one way, and I mean this coin manifests universal consciousness in a different way. So from that point of view, the question isn't which systems are conscious. The question is what kind of consciousness each system demonstrates, how it manifests universal consciousness. That's a very eccentric view for an AI scientist. I'm usually in a minority of one.
Surface, so it ends up on the trap surface. But on the trap surface, you've got the few light rays focusing. Once they start focusing inwards, there's nothing to stop them focusing inwards if the energy flux across the light rays is non-negative. So from that, you deduce that the boundary of this future is finite. Or what's called compact, really. And I had a rather sloppy argument in the paper about showing that this compact boundary to the future of the trap surface would lead you to an incompatibility with the initial Cauchy surface being non-compact. And so you have this finite boundary to this future, and you map it back onto this finite. I stupidly didn't use an argument that I knew when I described this argument to Charlie Misner, who was a contemporary of mine at Princeton. I studied, that's where I learned a lot of physics. After learning a lot from Dennis, I learned a lot more when I was at Princeton. Charlie Misner was the one there I got on pretty well with, and he said to me, why didn't you use a certain result, which he mentioned to me before, and I knew perfectly well. I said, my God, I should have used that result than the one I did do it. It makes the argument much neater, much easier. So using Charlie Misner's component to the argument, you get a really very direct and simple argument to show that the starting off from this open, that is a non-compact initial surface, becomes something which has this boundary, this trap surface which has the boundary of the future is compact.
Your brain, we could create something that's like a hybrid or not. It would be up to our own decision as to whether or not to do that. So there'll be some new ways of communicating.
Let me ask another question about this. This is what, when I was reading the book, this is where I kept getting stuck. You were extremely optimistic. You're optimistic about where we are today, optimistic that technology has been a massive...
Ask people, what's the chance that we're going to go another 80 years and this will never happen again? Nobody would say that that was true. But it has happened. Now, that doesn't mean it's not going to happen next week. But anyway, that's a great danger. And I think that's a much greater danger than computers are. Yes, there are dangers, but the computers will also be more intelligent to avoid kinds of dangers. Yes, there's some bad people in the world, but I mean, go back 80, 90 years. We had 100 million people die in Asia and Europe from World War II. We don't have wars like that anymore. We could, but we certainly have the atomic weapons to do that. And you could also imagine computers could be involved with that. But if you actually look, and this goes right through War and Peace, first of all, if you look at my lineage of computers, going from tiny fraction of one calculation to 65 billion, that's a 20 quadrillion fold increase that we've achieved in 80 years. And look at this, U.S. personal income. This is done in constant dollars, so this has nothing to do with inflation. And this is the average income in the United States. It's multiplied by about 100-fold. And we live far more successfully if you actually... People say, oh, things were great 100 years ago. They weren't. And you can look at this chart. I've got 50 charts in the book that show the kind of progress we've made. The number of people that live in dire poverty has gone down dramatically. And we actually did a poll where they asked people that live in poverty, has it gone up or down? 80% said it's gone up.
You are the contradiction. So that you can't do it. So it means. Now you see, is this what you call a singularity? In my paper, the title of the paper did say, mention the word singularity in the title. I don't think it's used anywhere else in the paper. And certainly when I looked at these things in more detail later, you could see that various things could happen. It doesn't have to be a singularity in the sense of Herbert is going to look too like in the Oppenheimer-Snyder collapse, but something problematic happens. And the sort of thing that is problematic is this Cauchy surface description doesn't work. You can't say the evolution of this initial data goes crazy, and you can't do it. And why it goes crazy might be for one reason or another. It doesn't necessarily mean that the singularities are of the nature of curvature going to infinity. In fact, I don't think I called them singularities in general. The term singularity was used much more broadly later on by Stephen Hawking. You see, I gave this talk at King's College, London, where I described this argument I give, which was done in 1964, in December of 1964, something like that. And I remember I was very pleased because John Singh, who was an Irish relativist, I was very pleased he was at my talk, because I liked his books very much, because they were all very geometrical, and I had a very geometrical way of thinking, and so I learned a lot from Singh's books. And so I gave the talk, and he was there. According to the movie, Stephen Hawking was at my talk, but that was quite wrong. Dennis Sharma heard about my talk, and he asked me to give a repeat at Cambridge. I gave a repeat at Cambridge. Stephen Hawking was present at that. I then had a sort of private talk afterwards with Stephen, with George Ellis, I think Brandon Carter, some of the time. Stephen picked up on these things very quickly and started to apply them to the cosmological singularity, the Big Bang singularity, which is an essential thing. And he ended up writing a thesis which a big part of that thesis had to do with singularity and cosmology. Yes, Stephen's PhD thesis. It actually consisted of four topics, curiously enough. Four topics, only one of which was on the singularity of the appearance and cosmology. What he'd done at that point. I remember writing in my report I was one of the referees, I should say. I was a referee, Dennis Sharma was a referee, and according to the movie, Kip Thorne was a referee. That's completely false. He was not there. We only had two referees. And I remember I had come armed with a list of typos and various little errors, and I brought them up, and he's corrected all of them by the time we had them. But you see, there were four parts to his thesis. Only one part consisted of this singularity theorem stuff, which he developed much more later on. But I think in my report I said any two parts would be good enough.
What's going to happen as AI takes over jobs. I'll also say, because we already have AI that can strategize, it's going back to the deep mind that beat every human being on the planet to the game of Go. And it did that by inventing strategies that no human had ever thought of before and probably could not have conceived of. And so that's been around for a decade, the fact that there's AI that can strategize better than humans can in that particular context, but then extrapolate a bit. And so one of my thoughts is it's not just the worker bees. What does a CEO do? Puts his or her feet up on her desk and says, okay, here's where business stands, and we need to do this, and we need to do that. And I can easily picture an AI taking over the role of a CEO. No, it's not just the people down through the bureaucracy, whether they're encouraging this employment is dead concept or not. This is going to be very disruptive and very complicated. And AI does not have to be conscious in order to do this. Just the current capacity, and it's going to get better over the next little bit, whether it becomes conscious or not. It's just going to be very disruptive. And for us to try to think about what that's like for society and each individual, thinking about how it plays them, that's the task for us all, individually and collectively. Because it's unstoppable, I think. I mean, no, this is not a top-down thing. I mean, a given business, Sam Altman comes in and says, I want to do this, this, and this. But collectively, that this is the whole shebang, do it.
This will be coming to humans fairly soon. But this is going to profoundly transform health and medicine and agriculture. Fertile rate, 103D volume per decade. We'll get to submicron around 2020. There are interesting niche applications today. We have, I think, over-enthusiasm. Maybe we've learned enough from our experience with the internet boom and bust that there won't be a major dislocation before we actually get to the exciting phase of three-dimensional printing, which I think will be the 2020s, early 2020s. In 2020, we'll be able to print out clothing. So people go, oh, great, there goes the fashion industry, because you'll be able to download, cool pre-designs that are open source, print them out for pennies per pound, which is what it costs. And people say, well, how's the fashion industry going to survive that? Well, look at some other industries that have already, today, been transformed already, going from physical products to digital products. They're actually doing quite well. I just kept, as I mentioned, when it was not in the interest of the human species for people to live past their 20s. So, for example, it doesn't recognize cancer. It says, oh, that's me. It doesn't go after it. It doesn't work on retroviruses. It has lots of limitations. We could create a new little intelligent device, just like our T cells, which are intelligent, but that doesn't have these limitations. That can download new software from the internet to combat new pathogens. And that will really be another significant increase to our life expectancy. Of course, you could always, your life expectancy could be whatever, 30 years, 50 years, 70 years from now, but you could still be hit by the proverbial bus tomorrow. But we're working on that also with self-driving cars. But something that's left out of these life expectancy projections is they assume the technology of today. So if someone uses life insurance statistics and say, well, this person has a remaining life expectancy of 40 years, that's assuming like nothing's going to happen in the next 40 years despite this exponential progression. We're going to get to a point where we're adding more time to your remaining life expectancy than it's going by in just 15 years. I mean, 20, 30, 40 years from now, it's going to be dramatically different. We're going to have the mature phases of these biotechnology and nanotechnology revolutions. So it's hardly a static system. It was a static system maybe 100 years ago. 200 years ago, people lived the same lives their grandparents did. They expected their grandchildren to do the same. That's really not the case anymore. So I'll say a few words about thinking. I've been thinking about thinking for 50 years. 50 years ago, I wrote a paper when I was 14 about how I thought the brain worked. And I described it as a series of modules. I didn't know how many there were, but I figured there were a lot of them. And each module could learn a pattern. And it could remember that pattern. It could recognize that pattern when it had encountered it in the future. It could implement that pattern. And these modules were organized in a hierarchy. And we created that hierarchy with our own thinking. And that's as far as I got 50 years ago. Based on that thesis, I wrote this program that could compose music based on the patterns it found in famous compositions. I got to be President Johnson. And I've been thinking about this for 50 years. There was very little to go on from neuroscience 50 years ago. But actually, there was one neuroscientist, Vernon Mountcastle, who had a thesis that was different than the common wisdom at that time, and even different than the common wisdom of a lot of neuroscientists today. The neocortex is this portion of the brain. You can see a picture of it right up there. It's got these convolutions and curvatures that you're familiar with. And it's the outer layer of the brain. And it's where we do our thinking. And it was thought that it had different regions, so they must be organized very differently. There's this region in the back of the head called V1, which is where the optic nerve spills into. And it recognizes very simple features of visual images, like the fact that that edge is straight, the fact that that edge is curved. It does these kind of simple features of visual images. There's a fusiform gyrus up here. It recognizes faces. We know that because if you knock it out through injury or stroke, suddenly people don't recognize faces. And there's a famous frontal cortex where we do language and art and science. So these different regions do such dramatically different things, it was thought they must work very differently. But Vernon Mountcastle did autopsies of the neocortex in all these different regions and found, they all look the same. Same interconnection pattern repeated over and over again. And so my thesis now is actually that they are all the same. I've counted them, 300 million of these modules. They can recognize a pattern. And when we became humanoids, we developed this frontal cortex. If you look at other primates, they have a slanted brow. They don't have the frontal cortex. So it's thought that this must be organized very differently because it does these fantastic things like learn language and art and poetry and science and conferences on innovation. No other species does that. But it's actually the same neocortex that we had before, just a greater quantity. Before we developed the frontal cortex, we had plenty of neocortex to do a very good job of being primates. Now we had this additional amount, so we could think abstract thoughts. And we actually invented language, which was our most important invention. So I could take this hierarchical structure and transfer those patterns.
Those two stories suggest that there are moves afoot, that there is a recognition out there among regulators that something's gone wrong. What role do the big tech companies play in lobbying?
Oh, a massive role. And that's why it's taken so long for regulation to even get to this point, because there are armies of lobbyists in Washington, D.C., backed by so much money from these companies, armies of lawyers as well. When you have cases against big tech companies by regulators, they get tied up in courts. It's constantly appealed. The recent case against Apple, the tax case, that was a decade in the making before they finally got fined for it.
They made a movie of it. The movie was stupid. It had nothing to do with the stories that it has necessarily a bad thing then anymore.
Well, this goes to the idea of blurring what it means to be human.
and blurring the boundary between human and machine.
Yeah.
And when you talked about humanity always, you know, striving towards being cyborgs, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like when we started using fire, you know,
yeah,
again, going way, way back there,
yeah,
we started to change what it meant to be human. And
right,
as we increase our technological competency, we keep changing the definition of humanity.
Yeah, we did.
But the reality is it's actually fallen by 50%. In the last 20 years. So what we think about the past is really the opposite of what's happened. Things have gotten far better than they have. And computers are gonna make things even better. I mean, just the kind of things you can do now with a large language model didn't exist 2 years ago.
Do you ever worry that, take it as a given, computers have made things better, take it as a given that personal income will keep going up?
And no one would advocate that. So we'll find things to do, we'll have other methods of distributing money, and it'll continue these kinds of curves that we've seen already.
It's kind of remarkable that we got large language models before we got robotic dishwashers.
More happy to live, and they'll want to continue to experience tomorrow. And
what about watermarking? I thought OpenAI were going to watermark everything that their systems produce.
Watermarking is often trotted out as this sort of solution, but everybody agrees it's also not a silver bullet. So let's discuss that. Why? Everybody's going to have to come up with some sort of watermarking that they would all agree upon and use. This becomes really interesting for things like blockchain, ways that you'd be able to do even like a chain of evidence. How do you verify? There's cybersecurity and cryptographic principles that we could use in this. The problem is it doesn't scale. It's really, really intensive. So, you know, what are we going to do? Every time we check a post on social media, we're going to have to do some sort of decryption to see if it's real. Like, that's what doesn't work. And you're right. They constantly, these tech companies, put the onus on the users to protect their data and now to decide what's true or not based on feelings. Weird.
You know, a theme we keep returning to in this program is, and in the mind of what we've just been discussing here, is how long it's going to take before we reach this thing known as singularity. What do I mean by that? Singularity is the term given to the point in human history when the machine has become smarter than those programming them. So the point where they don't really need us. Is that really likely to happen, or is it just a concept created by those who are making money from the technology of the future? There's no better panel to discuss it with. So let's begin with you, Connor. Are you a believer in singularity, or are you a skeptic? Even if we just get a computer as far as brains, let's say it runs
1,000 times faster than a human. Well, that means it can do 2 years of thinking per day, 2 years of labor per day. I mean, that if that exists already, like...
The point is that the machines become smarter.
Dovetails perfectly with this idea of singularity. And I think in no way does that minimize the role or necessity or importance of the human being in this upcoming technology.
Yeah. I mean, if it did have bad associations, I mean, I like the expression transhuman or the good stuff, and there's ways in which it resonated. Evolution is something which is evolving.
AI people. On the other hand, I'm going from Hong Kong onto Xiamen in China. In Xiamen, I'm working with my friend Hugo de Garris on a project.
So, waters rise and fall. And my feeling is America peaked more or less in the 60s.
So the first and biggest question is, where is the plateau? If indeed scientific and technological progress is following a sigmoid curve, which I believe there is plenty of evidence that it is, where is the plateau? Where is it going to taper off, and where are we going to end up? So that dude was an idiot. So I'm not going to fall into that trap and say we've invented everything that it is possible to invent. No. What I am saying, though, is that even with accelerating technology and science, the way that we live is not changing at an accelerated rate. If anything, the way that we live is changing at a slower rate. So, yes, can things get better? Absolutely. Can things still change? Yes, absolutely. Can we become a multiplanetary species? I don't see why not, but I'm not saying that it's going to be easy. And I think that this is one of the fantasies that people have, is that with more and more technological breakthroughs, things are just going to get exponentially easier. I do think that some things will get easier. Obviously, we would rather live today with our technology that we have today than we would like to live 200 years ago.
The kinds of arguments that are used, the argument being that you could apply them not just to a local collapse, but to sort of cosmic collapse. Because if you imagine that the Big Bang was the result of some kind of bounce, that there was a collapsing universe which bounced and came out again, and the argument that Stephen was working for, he did have some good arguments, were that you still had to have singularities. And eventually we wrote a joint paper together.
Language, which is itself a hierarchical structure. And that's like, but we're expecting an E, so it says, yeah, good enough. It says, yes, we've seen an E, and then Apple says, yes, we've seen Apple. And information goes up and down the hierarchy in this way. Go up another five levels. Now you're at a pretty high level of the hierarchy. It'll stretch out to the different senses. So you may have a module that sees a certain fabric, hears a certain voice quality, smells a certain perfume, and says, oh, my wife has entered the room. Go up another 10 levels, and now you're at a very high level, at a very abstract level, and you have modules that go, oh, that was funny. That's ironic. She's pretty. And you probably think that those modules are much more sophisticated, but they're actually not. It's the hierarchy below them that's more complicated, more sophisticated. So there was a 16-year-old girl, she was having brain surgery. She was talking to the surgeons, and they wanted to talk to her. And you can do that because there's no pain receptors in the brain. And whenever they stimulated these points in red, she would start to laugh. So at first they thought they were triggering some kind of laugh reflex. But no, they quickly realized that they were actually triggering the perception of humor. She just found everything hilarious whenever they stimulated these points. You guys are so funny just standing there as a typical comment. And they weren't funny, not while doing surgery. But they had found the points, at least some of them, in the neocortex that detected humor. And we can now begin to understand language. How many of you heard of the Bhati? 1,000 years ago, I couldn't reach that fruit at that higher branch, so we invented a tool that could extend our physical reach. We then extended our muscles and created great structures like the pyramids. Today, we can access all of human knowledge with a few keystrokes. A kid in Africa with a smartphone has access to more intelligent knowledge and information than the President of the United States did 15 years ago. And so ultimately, these are actually going to go inside our bodies and brains. I mentioned we'll have these intelligent nanobots that augment our immune systems.
So it's It's really, I think, quite promising to see talk of what they call structural changes, i.e. the possibility of a breakup for Google, because till now, it's just been fines. And, you know, a few years ago, Facebook was fined something like $5 billion, and the stock went up, because this is just pocket, you know, this is like a speeding ticket for these companies. It's the cost of doing business. And so it's what we're really seeing for the first time is momentum towards something a little bit more potentially damaging for these companies. But it's mostly coming from the U.S., and people in civil society who are pushing for this want to actually see a little bit more support from Europe as well, European regulators.
Who have, of course, the teeth. They've got the EU AI Act now. They've also got the Digital Services Act, the Digital Markets Act, GDPR. So the European Union is really led on regulation, but what they still don't do, I think, is enforce enough. And that's the thing, is they have potential to at least issue bigger fines, and they're not even doing that.
What for you, Gary, is the most urgent, the most pressing problem that lawmakers need to look at?
We need to protect the small developer. I mean, these two guys that we talked about, Sardis and Oliver, when they were small, they were brilliant. And there were huge advances. And as we said at the top, they now have a capital community.
It's putting so much money into a couple companies like OpenAI. And I think it's hurting society because we're not exploring different kinds of alternatives.
Computer. much about computers other than.
Thank you. thing, cold and melancholy, wail a blue finale for my tragedy, like a miserere meant for only me, while I linger weary neath the willow tree. Right here, our romance was started, here again we parted, when I set you free. All my thoughts are jumbled, everything is blurred, all the world has crumbled, shattered by a word. The end has come, my heart is numb, 'twas like a bolt from the blue above. I can't believe it, but you're gone, darling, and here lies love. The sky is dark, I hear a lark, he sounds as sad as a mournful dove. The dew appears like the tears of dawn, darling. There's only one thing I'm conscious of. I only know I can't go on, darling, and here lies love.
Value independent creative thought. CKUW.